Hey, it's Bobby Manning here with a new episode of Dome Theory. I'm recording this late on Wednesday night, Thursday morning. We're about to enter the All-Star break. That's a big reason you haven't heard too much of me on here. Celtics season, been doing a lot of writing coverage, Celtics post-game show, that kind of stuff. So I don't want to leave this out to dry too much. I've gotten some good material the last couple weeks, though, so I feel like that's what I'm going to dump on you this week is a great interview I had with Drew Hanlon, the trainer of Bradley Beal, RJ Barrett, Jason Tatum, Joel Embiid, Zach LaVine, Kelly Oubre, among many others in the league, Semi Ojeleye for my Celtics people out there. He became known as the super trainer who was highly influential in consolidating and improving the offensive games, in particular of a number of top stars around the NBA. And he had these massive camps throughout the off seasons where some of the biggest stars in the game would be going against each other, and there'd be these highlight videos, and it was a great spectacle back then. But he continues to be highly influential in the lives of Bradley Beal and Tatum. All three of them grew up in St. Louis. Hanlon was a Belmont guy, played college basketball. Tatum, of course, went on to Duke after playing at Chaminade High School in the footsteps of Bradley Beal, who was 4 years ahead of him. And one thing we heard this week is that with both Beal and Tatum making the All-Star game, this could be the first time in their organized basketball lives that they're going to be playing basketball together. And I got a chance to see them at the Garden on Sunday, and There's this thing I always think about, not getting jaded in this career, because I've been doing this about 8 years now, 9 years, probably going to be this fall. You know, I started slow, started small, about 4 years in or so, it picked up with the Celtics work I was doing and into the podcasting realm. This got started about 5 years ago now, as it will be this summer, and I don't want to get jaded ever. I don't want to be at these games bored. I don't want to be unimpressed by what's in front of me. And so you remind yourself, what would me at 14 have said, having the opportunity here to see Bradley Beal, Jason Tatum facing off in the Garden when no one else can go to these games? That was special. That was emotional. And seeing the visual artistry of the games stuck out to me so much. And I talked to Drew a little bit about that, how the greats had this allure to them that made the NBA special. Whether it was Michael Jordan and his, you know, roundabout finishes and athleticism and dunking around the rim, he made the dunk famous in many ways. You know, Dr. J too. Then you had Kobe's array of moves, spins, fadeaways. The Kobe. You know, the Kobe is the Kobe. Dirk's fadeaway, Duncan's glass shot, the mid-range he had, and then even more modern guys, the power of LeBron, the grace of a guy like Kyrie Irving. That's what makes this league special. And Tatum, Beal, the expressiveness of their game is frustrating for some, in Tatum's case, when he gets a little inefficient, but I see the dominance and the flair with which he ends that game, going for four straight buckets, I think it was, to overcome Beal's 46 points and the magnificent stretch he went on from about the 4 minute mark to the 2 minute, 1 minute mark of this game. And the Celtics overcame a 5 point deficit in about 40 seconds. And so I was curious. What's it like for Hanlon to see those two face off? I noticed that Beal defends Tatum about as well as anyone, even though he's 5 inches shorter than him. So those are all kind of things I wanted to get a feel for when Hanlon's watching those two face off. And they faced off 3 times this year. Beal, I think, has held Tatum to 38% in those games, but couldn't stop him in crunch time at this one. It ended up being an important win that was the middle game in a 3-game win streak. The Celtics will try to continue tonight against the Raptors. I also talked to Chris Kirshner, who covers the Hawks within the last few weeks. We talked a little bit about Lloyd Pierce's job. I know Lloyd Pierce got fired since we talked. Another thing I've been thinking about in the sports world the last few weeks, and really months, is the veil of normalcy, normal expectations, normal procedure, and a normal approach to scheduling. Let's say nights off. I guess that fits under scheduling. Expectations more than anything. All those things haven't changed despite how much the world has changed around sports. Ratings are down in a massive way, and that's obviously going to have consequences on everybody involved. I mean, they're having an all-star game this weekend. In part, it feels like because the ratings were fantastic last year and was a massive, massive money grab in just one night. And normally it's a couple different nights spread out, but this is just going to be one big money cash grab for the league. And we all know this is a business. We all know what everybody's in this for at the highest level of sport. But the risk here, the pressure and log of minutes and games that are already being pressed on some of the biggest stars in this game, many of whom have gone through COVID now. When you think of Tatum, Karl Anthony Towns isn't going to be going to the game, but his experience was quite dramatic with COVID. I'm trying to think of some other people in the All-Star game that went through it. Harden, right? Yeah, James Harden had it. Who else? KD? KD's not going. Yeah, quite a few of them have had it. So it's a crunch. It's a mental pressure on these athletes this year that is incomparable. There's a physical toll, and then of course there's a disease toll for some of them, but the expectations are the same. So the Hawks get off to a slow start. They're banged up. Their games are condensed. Bunch of back-to-backs, all that stuff. There's internal reports about what was going on in that room, and there was also past seasons of struggle for the Hawks. But the context here is that the Hawks have gone through an array of years where they have rebuilt, then flipped the switch to win now when they weren't quite ready to win now. And then they look at that and say, oh, we weren't ready to win that. Let's spend all our money because we have the most cap space in the league. We're going to spend all our money and we're going to go all in on this year, even though we're young, even though we're developing in our core, which probably needs minutes. We'll now be competing with Bogdan Bogdanovic and Danilo Gallinari. Clint Capella was a big addition last year, one of the biggest trades of all time. And now Lloyd Pierce is gone. Now, you saw the tea leaves there. I said it on a special for CLNS that even though he was plus 750, look out for Lloyd Pierce with the way the Hawks are playing. And after Nate coached a few games while Lloyd was away with a family emergency to add to the cruelty of this, the Hawks dismissed him about a week later. And coaches around the league were irate. I know Rick Carlisle in particular called it a blow to the profession. Others viewed it through a lens of vulnerability in coaching and in sports in general, that you could always be replaced, overturned, and that's what you expect in that position. It almost drives you in a way. But this one felt a little more cruel in a year that isn't normal. The normal approach was taken, and that's continued to happen, not only in the pros where it's one thing, but in college sports as well. And one of my favorites, Bomani Jones, has documented that fairly widely, the buyout payouts to these fired coaches in a year where athletic departments are cash strapped and some have had to let programs go and things like that. But it's that forced normalcy, and college more than anything plowed ahead, and you're going to see it this month with March Madness getting going. College basketball made it, not without losing some teams and powerful programs having disappointing seasons, probably associated in some way to what's going on. Jalen Johnson dropping out of Duke and other players moving on. You had quite a number of games canceled outright. I know Syracuse had two layoffs, one associated with themselves and their positive tests, and one that wasn't. In a Louisville sense, they got those Louisville games thrown out the window, so now they're going to have to play all the more consequential ACC tournament games. And really, we're doing all these conference tournaments, we're doing all these gatherings in cities around the country ahead of this March Madness experiment. I don't know. There is the sense out of the NCAA that they're going to plow forward no matter what, whether it's positive cases or teams that end up getting decimated by a virus outbreak or anything like that in Indianapolis where they're going to do this thing. Good luck. That will be a cash grab for sure. There is no TV event, and never mind the gambling implications now as gambling has gone legal around the country on sports. Billions will be tossed around this month, and a pandemic be damned. Mask mandates going away in certain states and all that. Effectively under Biden, and I hate to take it this route, but it's happened. You know, liberal, conservative, we've seen in both those kind of states that once Trump went away, the pressure, the awareness, the urgency regarding this virus has dropped quite a bit. And cases have dropped. Vaccinations are going up. I think Biden's handling vaccination fairly well. The new target is going to be May for almost every American to be vaccinated. That's impressive. I mean, this whole vaccination effort, back to Trump even, has been an unmatched success so far. Again, we got to see how this all goes. That's a whole different conversation when we're getting into vaccines. But so far, so good. So I'm Bobby Manning. This is Dome Theory. You want to get some of those thoughts off my chest, sports related at this point? Check out my story with Drew Hanlon and check out our post-game show tonight and some of the video content we'll be putting out there both on my channel and the CLNS channel over this break over the next week. Hopefully we can do some storytelling stuff. I know I've been working on a little mini Kobe documentary that's going to be coming out on the airwaves here at some point soon. Other ideas being tossed around. But for now, Drew Hanlon is talking about Beal. He's talking about Tatum. He's talking about COVID. And then we're talking to Kirshner about this All-Star game where Gucci Mane, Pooh Shiesty is ready. The events are on. Keisha Lance Bottom said stay away from Atlanta, but the Atlanta club said come on in. All-Star Weekend, baby. We're here. And this is Dome Theory. iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. All of those places. Subscribe. 5 stars. Rating and review. Hopefully from a positive point of view. And subscribe to our YouTube channel. And subscribe to my newsletter. BobbyManning.substack.com. I'm on Twitter at RealBobManning. You can read me at CLNSmedia.com, CelticsBlog.com, and BostonSportsJournal.com. And you can listen to me here on Dome Theory. Drew Hanlon's up next. Chris Kirshner's later. Let's do it.
I started working with Brad when he was 13 years old, and Brad was like my guinea pig. And when I say that, it's just, you know, we basically try stuff out and then tweak stuff to make it more efficient. And then once we had a kind of an efficient way to master a new skill, then I was able to use that methodology with other players like Jason and Zach and, you know, so on. But with Jason, we've added a lot of Brad Beal's tag to his game. And so, we know each other's tendencies. You know, I always tell people that if anything were ever to happen to me, people are always like, oh my God, if anything were ever to happen to you, what would your players do? And I was like, well, I know Brad's got a good amount of years left in his NBA career. I was like, but Brad knows the curriculum and all my training methods better than anyone. So I said, you know, they just have to ask Brad for help and hopefully he was willing to help out some of the other pure sweat guys. But, that's a long-winded answer just to basically say that, you know, they have so many similarities just because they've trained, using the same methodology since they were both 13 years old.
So what stuck out to you about last night from them individually, like things that they're doing at a higher level this year that have allowed them to, you know, become all-star starters, and Beal's case, the scoring leader in the league? You know, I think what sticks out for me for Beal was the way he switched onto those centers, especially Rob, and like pulled them out of the post, created those open lanes for himself. Like the way he commands those switches sticks out to me so much with him. And then I think the play that stuck out to me most with Tatum was that spin move. You know, he got Beal in the post, spun off him in that spot, and then hit like a one-footed fadeaway with the left foot there. I mean, those are the two things that stuck out to me. What stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think they both do it in different ways. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of Brad's baskets are within kind of the flow of the team offense. You know, a lot of ball screens, a lot of dribble handoffs, a lot of back doors if they're top blocking him. You know, that's where he gets the majority of his points. And, you know, he's doing it in a different way than a lot of other guards. You know, a lot of guards are so, you know, 3 points heavy, whereas Brad is, you know, getting downhill and scoring the paint and, you know, takes mid-range jumpers, which I know that, you know, scares some people. But I think that's the way that Brad does it, whereas Jason is, he's more of an isolation player where, you know, he's generating a lot of his own offense, whether that's behind the three-point line, the side steps and heavy pull-ups, or whether that's in the mid-post with, you know, face-up moves or, you know, fadeaways, you know, if he's in a back-down situation. So I think while they share a ton of similarities, and while they both have the ability to do, you know, the same skills, I think they use their packages in different ways, you know, based on their body type. You know, Brad is a, you know, Brad is one of the strongest pound-for-pound basketball players that you'll ever meet, and he really uses physical drives and, you know, attacking angles to his advantage, whereas Jason uses his length and size to shoot over people. And so that's the big thing that stands out to me is that even though they both do have similarities, they both have step backs and side steps, they both, you know, rely on scoring at all the different levels. I think they just do it in different ways, and that's mainly based on kind of what fits them best.
What did you see on that game-winning shot? I mean, they were lined up against each other. Tatum threw an inbounds. I think someone did like a stopwatch on that inbounds. It was like 4.98 seconds. Like the ref was like just about to throw that 5 seconds out there, and then he got it in, got it back, and it pretty much just looked like he turned the corner on Beal there. And the scoop layup was ridiculous. Like, what did you see there? What was like your reaction when that happened?
Yeah, so my reaction, I mean, you know, I mean, I just watching the whole game play out. You know, I mean, Brad had a couple amazing. He had the end one. He had the 3-pointer where Jason fouled him. Then he had the layup where he scored in the timeout. And then Jason with, you know, the last, what was it, six points, I think, or 8 points in you know, a minute and a half. It was basically like them playing one-on-one. And so, you know, my mom and I were watching the game, and we're just going back and forth. And when Jay scored, I was happy for Jason. And then I was like, all right, now we get to see what Brad has on the other end. And so, ironically, Shimmy Olajay, who's another guy I work with, trapped Brad. So it was like, you know, all three of my guys kind of, you know, in that corner. But, you know, I was hoping that Brad would get a chance to go back at Jason and so that they could go kind of mano a mano one more time to solve the game. But, I was really impressed with Jason's mission ability. I think that one of the biggest areas that we need to address is him finishing around the rim. He's just got to be more effective when he gets to the basket and not settle for floaters or runners. And for him to actually get to the basket, you know, he can take contact and still finish, that was a thing that stood out for me.
So what's that like for you this year with, like, you know, some of the travel limitations and like, these guys really are kind of boxed off in the world, you know, with all the protocols and stuff. So I remember, you probably remember this too, because it was such, like, a big day. There was a practice last March, probably just about a year ago. I saw you there working with them, you know, getting a little work in at Celtics practice after. And I think that was the last Celtics practice before the league got shut down. Right before they went out to Indiana and Milwaukee, and they got shut down that day. So are you able to get in any work with these guys during the year? How did you kind of handle the off-season work differently? Like, you know, how did COVID affect all that?
Yeah, so, I mean, COVID definitely made the off-season a lot shorter. I only got to spend a couple weeks with the guys this year, and so we just had to really lock in on maybe, you know, one thing that we could really add to each person's game. And, you know, and during the season, just because of protocols, you know, I have to quarantine after I travel, get tested, get registered, multiple negative tests, and then also use a mask and keep my distance when I am working them out, which obviously impacts what you can do on the court. So there have been a lot of unique changes just because of COVID, but I still do a ton of video work for each guy. I'm FaceTiming them before and after every game. And then, you know, I've been out to see each one of my guys throughout the season, just sprinkled in here and there, you know, with whenever they need me.
And did you, I kind of want to get a feel for that friendship between Beal and Tatum, because I saw Jason, after he threw down that dunk on Robin, you know, gave Beal a little pat on the backside. Tatum's kind of like a quiet guy, but he does kind of have like that subtle personality to him in a moment like that. Like, I think he said last night that him and Brad text every day. You know, what's kind of that relationship between them? How'd they become friends?
Yeah, so Brad Beal's mom was Jason Tatum's mom's volleyball coach in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it goes way beyond just Brad and Jason. And the reason that I actually work with Jason is because of Brad. Brandy, Jason's mom, called me when Jason was in, like, seventh grade and was like, hey, I'd love for you to work with my son. And I said, you know, I'm not in St. Louis that much. You know, and I really don't do as many individual workouts with kids. You know, I have camps and clinics and stuff like that that I do spottingly, but I don't really have any full-time clients that are younger. And, you know, so she reached out to Brad. Obviously, I was working with Brad at the time. Brad was only, I don't know, Brad wasn't, I don't know at what point that was in Brad's career. We'd have to do the math based on, like, how old he was. But basically, she called Brad and said, is there any way that you can possibly have Drew work out Jason? And so Brad called me and was like, hey, he's a little brother to me. You know, is there any way you could, you know, work him out and stuff like that? And so that's how I actually started training Jason was, you know, I had turned down Brandy at a young age. And, you know, and Brad was the one that kind of stepped in and said, hey, man, I'd really appreciate it if you could work out with Jason. He's like a little brother to me. But they've been friends forever just because of their parents, you know, because they're moms. So, you know, Jason kind of grew up in Brad's footsteps. You know, he went to the same high school. He worked with me, which was the same. He played for the same AAU team. You know, they're both one and done. They're both number three picks. I mean, it's just crazy how similar their careers have been. And even the record book of Chaminade, they both won one state championship. Jason was three-time Gatorade Player of the Year in Missouri. Brad was only two-time, and then they both won Gatorade National Player of the Year as seniors in high school. So, I mean, it's just crazy that you're both National Gatorade Players of the Year. You're both from the same high school. You both have the same trainer. You both play on the same AAU team. You both, ironically, they both finished second at Peach Jam, too. Both their AAU teams finished second at Peach Jam. So, I mean, it's really unbelievable how similar their careers have been. And maybe it's because they did the same things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They went through the same exact kind of, you know, childhood.
Yeah, for sure. And I know Jason said last night that after all that, they never got to play together, you know, in an organized game. So that's a possibility next week. I know you want to see Joel, Brad, and Jason together on the same team there. It's going to be tough.
And Zach.
Yeah, and Zach.
I want all my guys on the same team.
Yeah. That draft's going to have to go some type of way for that to happen. But you'll get at least two, I think.
I know.
And the odds are probably in favor at least two.
Well, there has to be at least two on a team. On one team, just because, you know, it's going to be two and two minimum. But it was funny because I got on, I sent a group. We all have a group message. So I have a group text with Jason and Brad only, and then I also have a group text with Jason, Brad, Joel, and Zach. And so we've been, you know, we talk all the time, all four of those guys throughout the season. And but one of the things that that I said after the All-Star game, you know, was announced. I said, hey, listen, I said, next year I need one of you guys to be a leading vote getter and captain so we can finally get everybody on the same team. And so that's you know, something I'm trying to make them very aware of, that that's something that I want them now.
You're going to be at the game, I bet, right? Because you watched Jason down there in Atlanta a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I watched Jason down in Atlanta, but honestly, I'm not going to be at the game. I'm going to Miami to train some guys during the break.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you know anything about me, I think you know that all I do is work. So,
yeah.
You know, even though it'd be fun to be at the game, and you know, I think most people think I'm crazy to turn down All-Star tickets, especially when they're, you know, limiting everybody in the, you know, who can come. It's just, for me, if there's guys that won't work, that's always going to take precedence.
Yeah. Do you know if Jason's doing, I think he mentioned yesterday, he's either doing the three-pointer or the skills competition. Has he decided yet?
He hasn't decided yet, but I think he's going to do a three-point contest. He already won the skills competition, so we're trying to tell him to check out doing the box.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. How's he doing? Because he had COVID. The week since, it feels like he's been a little off, and then he bounced back, and you know, he said he had some breathing issues at one point, but you know, the last two games have been amazing.
You're nice to say he was a little off. Yeah, he was terrible.
Yeah,
for a little stretch. Yeah, I mean, it really. He told me, he was like, "Hey, listen," he's like, "You know, there's two sides of it. One side is, it is a lot harder to catch your breath, and it is a lot harder to breathe and, you know, get that second wind. And the second part is, you know, mental side of it. You know, they're constantly telling you, hey, let us know if anything's wrong. So every time that you feel your lungs or you feel a headache or whatever, you start overthinking and start, you know, kind of multiplying the symptoms.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that's what he was really dealing with, was a combination of the physical and the mental side of the virus.
All right, and it sounds like you're getting into the gym, so I'll let you go. I just
no, you're good.
Last thing I wanted to ask about was like the artistry of their games, and you mentioned this a little bit, but it kind of struck me last night when they're playing each other. Does that Kobe thing? You know, he worked with Kobe a little bit. He obviously idolized him. Resembles a little bit of his game, Jason did. And then you talk about the mid-range. Like, to me, the artistry of the mid-range is what made guys like Melo, Kobe, Paul Pierce, whoever you want to mention there, just like their distinctive styles. It just had, like, such a poetry in their games. And I feel like they're kind of the next step of that. You know, there's a lot of spot-up shooters in the league today. There's a lot of, you know, drivers and finishers, stuff like that. You know, it's threes and layups pretty much for most of the guys in this league. But they do a little bit of everything. It feels like there's that artistry, poetry, like, you know, how do you take that in? How do you see that when it's compared to some of the other greats that have played this game?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it all the time. Like, if you think about the, you know, all the teams that have won championships over the last, let's say, 30 years, you've got Michael Jordan, you got Hakeem Olajuwon, you got Dwayne Wade, you got Kobe Bryant, you got Tim Duncan, you got Shaq, you got Dirk Nowitzki, you got LeBron. All those guys won championships in the mid-range. Even Kawhi Leonard, you know, even if you look at KD, the 2 years that he helped the Warriors win, you know, if you add up all the finals MVPs, they've actually shot twice as many mid-range jump shots as they have three-point jump shots in the playoffs in the postseason that they won. So, saying that, it's more so just about taking what the defense gives you and trying to get a basket. And we're very aware, you know, both Jason and Brad have made big strides in eliminating long twos. You know, that's one big thing that both of them have improved on, especially, you know, you see Jason shooting a lot more threes than he ever has before. But, you know, the big thing for us is just take what the defense gives you, and if the defense is running off the three-point line, don't be afraid to, you know, get a good on-balance, you know, mid-range jump shot that's going to help get your team a basket.
And you mentioned Shemmy real quick. What are you seeing from him this year? He looks so much better to me. He really does. Whether it's a 3-point shot, that short roll read that he made down the stretch,
yeah.
Defense. I mean, he's just a different player this year.
Anything I'd say about him, Shemmy's always you know, worked to get to where he's at. You know, he's spent a lot of time making tweaks and adjustments to his three the last couple of years. But the big thing that stood out to me is the confidence that he's playing with this year. And so he's got he's got, number one, he's got opportunity, and opportunity plays a huge role in being able to get a little bit of a flow into the game. But I think that's the biggest thing that I would say is he's finally got an opportunity. And then two, over the last couple of years, he's made a ton of tweaks and adjustments to his mechanics that have allowed him to be a more confident three-point shooter and get the results that he's getting now.
Drew, always good to talk to you. How's the golf game?
It's going well. I shot 7 over yesterday. I was at Belle Reve, which is the 2018 U.S. Open course that, Tiger ended up, he blew a lead down the stretch. But I was feeling really good after yesterday's game, so round.
I'll start with your story, I guess, here before we get into some of the Celtics and Hawks stuff. Well, what originally pushed you towards the sports media career? I see you've done some TV, but now you're in the writing lane.
Yeah. When I was in eighth grade, I decided that sports writing or sports media was something that I wanted to pursue. And then when I got to school at the University of Florida, I majored in journalism, did a lot of sports coverage there, particularly on the TV side of things. And then once I learned that you don't make much money in local TV, I decided that writing was the path for me to, potentially get, a lot of money one day. Still working on that, but it does seem like it's more lucrative than the local TV path. But, I've grown up just around sports my entire life. I grew up in the Bronx, just miles away from Yankee Stadium, and downtown New York obviously is home of the Knicks. So that's just a little bit about what I've been doing for my life around sports so far.
So the Yankees this year, are they going to get it together? Because I know I went to Syracuse. I know quite a number of Yankees fans, frustrated Yankees fans, which probably 10, 20 years ago, you didn't think that would be the staple of a Yankee fandom. But I mean, you got these big time pitchers, you got this massive salary, but it's just not converting. And you understand that when it's against the Houston Astros, who are similarly, loaded in terms of talent and payroll and all that stuff. But once it becomes the Tampa Bay Rays, you're chasing from behind. That's got to be frustrating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the Yankees haven't won a championship since 2009. Obviously our biggest rival is the Red Sox, and the Red Sox have won several in this time period from 2009. So it is frustrating, and it's also frustrating that, like you said, the Rays are, they've been in the mix for several years now, even though their payroll is so low. They just do a really good job of building up through the farm system. But I hope it's the year for the Yankees. I do have worries about the pitching staff. They obviously have Gerrit Cole, but outside of him, it just seems like they're relying on guys to, reach their highest upside to, be in contention. So I'm curious to see how it's going to work out. The lineup is great. Arguably, one of the top two lineups in baseball, along with the Dodgers. So we'll see if the lineup is able to carry them to the World Series.
I'm mildly excited for the Red Sox as a Boston guy, and I was last year too at this time, of course, before spring training got nixed and the season got delayed and all that stuff. That obviously put a damper on it, and then you get into the year and you're just waiting and waiting and waiting, and then the Sox come along. I watched 2 games and I realized, oh, this team just isn't it, and I couldn't get connected for the rest of the year. And last place, no fans in the stands, and the poor taste of the Mookie Betts trade in everybody's mouth. I've never seen Boston, which is through and through a baseball city. And I think New York probably still is too, because the Yankees are probably the most successful team left there.
they didn't care at all. You know, no one in Boston cared about baseball last year at all, which I've never seen before in my life. So I'm hoping that's a little different this year. I think there'll probably be some fans back at Fenway. The team will probably be a little bit better. But I know once this excitement of spring training gets by, and if they're not hitting the ground running, it's going to be easy to tune that out again, especially the way, you know, some of us have gotten frustrated with baseball and the pace of play and all those things. But when you have a bad team, it takes it to another level to try to stay locked into it. But I do want to talk Hawks, Celtics. We have this mini series here. For you, potentially, if this was a year where you were traveling, you'd be spending 3-4 days in Boston for a series like this, which is definitely something that's been missed this year. Have you gotten to travel at all? Are you doing this all from home? Are you going to Hawks games?
Yeah, I'm going to Hawks games. No travel. It's, you know, there's just no reason to travel if you're a reporter, just because everything is on Zoom nowadays. Yeah. So you're getting special access if you're actually in the building. Going to games themselves, like it doesn't bother me, just because of the fact, like, I live 2 miles from the arena. So it's not like I have to like push through traffic or anything like that. It's just right around the corner for me. So if I lived further away there, I probably would not go to the games, just because, again, everything is on Zoom and you're not really getting anything. You can see some things like during timeouts, just to see like how the team is interacting with one another, or if anybody's pissed off or anything like that. But no, everything's on Zoom, unfortunately.
So the Hawks this year, they're not great. They've been banged up. The defense is better, which is a step, certainly, when we look at the last few years there and the potential. They've been derailed by a lack of defense. Trae Young, still the kind of guy who is putting up monster numbers on one side of the floor, giving it up a little bit more on the other side. But I was at the game on Wednesday, and I see, you know, Nate McMillan's coaching these two games in Boston here, and he has obviously done something to take this team defensively to another level. But I hear great communication, whether it's from the bench, on the court. Those are the kind of things you hear in an empty stadium, and Boston completely empty, whereas Atlanta, you know, you got a few thousand down there. And I was mildly impressed with their defense. Now, Jason Tatum tore them up, especially late into the fourth quarter. John Collins had that costly foul that helped the Celtics get within four, but it was like 13 seconds left. So ultimately, pretty strong defensive effort against a team with two superstar wings, possible weaknesses at the guard position where you could get in the switches and stuff and get burned by those guys. Now, they were in the second half, especially, I thought the Hawks were able to hold them to long droughts and hold their own, whether it be Cam Reddish or Clint Capela in the post, and others who were able to rotate in there and give it a pretty, you know, fair defensive shot against this team. Now, they've been inconsistent, but it doesn't seem like defense is the issue this year.
No, I mean, the defense has been fine. A lot of the games, it's been offense, which has been a surprise, because most people coming into the season had the opposite concern, where it was going to be, how is this team going to get a lot of stops? Because they were going to be relying on guys like Cam Reddish and DeAndre Hunter, who's going to be out for, you know, several more weeks with a knee injury. But a lot of the focus was on those two guys in particular, and the growth needed to be at least an average defensive team. But you've had guys like John Collins take a leap forward defensively. Kevin Herter's gotten better defensively, and Clint Capela has really risen his game defensively and been the anchor in the middle of this defense. So I would say that for the Hawks, it's more so about just consistency on offense to, you know, have them in these games.
And Rondo's out. Bogdanovich is out long-term now. Hunter, you mentioned. Injuries have piled up on this team. And Danilo Gallinari, too, is not hurt, but something's wrong there. I mean, that's not the same guy we've seen with the Thunder and a couple other teams the last few years. That was a multi-year deal, too. That one's going to hurt them if it continues to go this way. But overall, decent-looking team there. The Capela trade, originally the four-team deal that they did, is looking like a success. I mean, that's just a perfect role man for Young, as we saw on Wednesday. And then you got young players abound. Cam Reddish has really turned around. That guy was kind of a laughingstock among prospects with how far he had slid. And now he was comfortably defending Tatum and Brown on that perimeter when he had the opportunity there, and a great four spacer from the corner for them too. So these moves, the draft picks, all the stuff that they're working on over the years is, you know, come together a little bit. So
in terms of goals for this team this year, probably playoffs, right? Like maybe even above the play-in tournament level there.
Yeah, I mean, even before the pandemic hit, Lloyd Pierce was talking about making the playoffs back in March of last year. So early March, right before the Gobert positive test came down, and obviously the league halted. But yeah, this has been something that they've been talking about for over a year now, about getting that next step in, which is making the playoffs. For the past couple of years now, they've been rebuilding through the draft, trying to get bad expiring contracts, and trying to trade them for additional draft picks, which is what they've done over the past few years. This was the first offseason where they actually made significant moves to help bolster the talent on this team. You mentioned Gallinari. They signed him to a three-year deal. They signed Bogdan Bogdanovic to a four-year deal, got him in restricted free agency from Sacramento. Chris Dunn hasn't played a game yet, but they got him in free agency as well. They signed Rajon Rondo. Rondo hasn't really done anything. I think it was an egregious error to sign him, because he just doesn't offer him the coin anymore. But they did, you know, try and get these moves to help them reach the playoffs. They've dealt with a lot of injuries so far, and that's been a big reason why they're currently under 500 right now.
Yeah, for sure. And that Bogdanovic one was a killer. That's, of all the moves you mentioned, that was the one that was going to move the needle more, especially on the offensive end of the floor. They've certainly missed him. So, you know, it's a fun team. I wonder what the, you know, sentiment is around that group the last couple of years, though, with the fans and with the team as a whole, because this all goes back to this incarnation of the Hawks right now, that draft night where they take Luka Doncic and trade him to Dallas. And you have these two players in Trae Young and Luka Doncic now, who are two of the best young players in the league. But Doncic last year in particular, shout out to this, you know, possibly MVP level campaign, and almost upset the Clippers in the first round, and was just the heart of the league. And, you know, you're getting crazy levels of comparisons, whether it be Larry Bird or, you know, possibly one of the best basketball players ever, some people have said, when it comes to Doncic. So you left in Atlanta with this phenomenal all-star, superstar young player in Young, but you're also in a place where you say, could we have gotten Doncic? Did we make an all-time blunder there and missing him, even though we're left with something good there? Like, how do the fans in particular grapple with that a couple years later now?
I really don't think the Hawks fans, most of them, care anymore.
All right.
Trae has been their guy that they've rallied around. They defend Trae very strongly and passionately. From the Hawks fans that I've interacted with, there's going to be some people who think it's a bad trade or whatever. But for the most part, at least from my interactions, it seems like they don't mind the trade. They love Trae. They think Cam has, you know, MVP potential, which, I mean, I don't see that, but that's what they feel like. So I would just say that for the most part, the Hawks fans have been okay with the trade, whether you agree with it or not. I think it ended up being fine for both parties. Both guys are the best two players in that draft class. Luka being one and Trae being two, in my opinion, but you know, both these guys are all stars. So I just don't see any, big time, like, holy cow, like, this is such a blunder. I can't believe what the Hawks did, like, move them to Seattle or whatever, like, people want to say. It's at the end of the day, it worked out fine, because Trae is, you know, a really special talent.
Is that a thing, going to Seattle? Do people talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, like, some people want to joke about just, you know, the trade and just the fact that it was such an egregious error, but
yeah,
it is what it is. People are going to complain about everything, so it's I don't think the Hawks general manager Travis Schlenk is, you know, going to go on the record and say, like, you know, this is, I shouldn't have done this or whatever. He's going to defend his guys, and that's what he's done when he's been asked about it over the past couple of years now.
So Atlanta, they lost 7 of 8 coming into Wednesday, and they put together a pretty good showing there. Young, it felt like he started slow and then just exploded late. And on the Boston side, there was all this talk of Jeff T coming in and defending him, which I understand. You don't have Kemba Walker. You don't have many other options at guard. You wanted someone who could get on the ball a little bit and defend him there. And like I get the creativity of it, saying that this guy was practicing with Trae Young every day last year, was on the Hawks last season, and so he probably has as good a shot as anybody of defending Young. And hey, that did not come to fruition. Young pretty much just tore him up on a couple different plays. I think ended 2 or 3 against him in the game, and had that final, like, you know, just rip off the crossover from the right corner into the lane, hitting Capella again, which happened about a million times on Wednesday. It was just another flat game from the Celtics, especially on the defensive side of the floor. And the league rankings really don't make that much sense this year, where the Celtics can come into this game 6th in defense and end up looking like that on that end of the floor. And so they have their own injuries too. Smart's out, Kemba's out, Tice was out for this game, all that stuff. But what were your general takeaways on Wednesday for both teams?
I think my takeaway from the Hawks side of things is that, you know, as you mentioned at the start of this, Nate McMillan was coaching last night, and Hawks fans have been very critical of Lloyd Pierce's job. You know, a lot of them don't think he's done a good job this season. And in my opinion, when Trae has a performance like he did the other night, when he's getting to all of his spots, he's making every shot. He's hitting deep threes. The floater is falling. He's drawing fouls. It doesn't matter who's necessarily the coach, just because of the fact that when Trae is at that level where he's in control, I think he had 8 turnovers. But other than that, I mean, he was incredible. Even on the defensive end of the floor, which has been a problem for him through his 3 seasons, I mean, he's never going to be a lockdown defender. But if he's as active as he was on Wednesday, you know, I think he had a deflection on Jaylen Brown in the post. He was getting in passing lanes. Like, those are the things that the Hawks have been talking about to help him elevate his game on that end of the floor, because we already know what he can do offensively. He's gifted on that end. But if he can get to, you know, just elevate his game a little bit on the defensive end, which I think he was very engaged on that end of the floor on Wednesday, I think the Hawks' potential just increases that much more, just because of that fact that it's hard to build around someone who's really bad defensively like Young has been. But if he can just improve a little bit, I think, you know, they would be thrilled with that, because it just puts a little less stress on the guys who surround him when you're talking about roster construction and all that stuff. As far as the Celtics go, I mean, it was clear from the moment the game started that it was going to be an issue for them to guard the paint. When you have guys like Capella and Collins who are really good at rolling to the rim, and they don't have anybody there to protect the rim, it's going to be hard to win that game. So I'm curious to see if Tice is going to make a difference there. At least now they have, you know, more size to go up against Capella and Collins in the front court. Interested to see if Kemba is going to make any sort of difference, because I mean, it didn't matter which guard was, when you mentioned T was guarding him for a little bit, it didn't matter which point guard was guarding him, if it was Peyton Pritchard or Javonte Green or whatever, it didn't matter. Trae was just going to cook whoever was in front of him. So I'm interested to see if Kemba makes any sort of difference there. So those are probably some of the things that I'm looking for going into tonight's game.
Yeah, more fully loaded on the Celtics side for sure. And I was looking at these 2-game series earlier in the year, like the numbers on it. Are these just all going to be splits? Is this just going to be an adjustment game in the game 2 every time, and it's just split city for the rest of the year? It's actually been a decent amount of sweeps here, whether it be the Raptors sweeping the Bucks yesterday, quite a few of those throughout this season. I think the Lakers had just recently swept the Thunder off the top of my head. I haven't been keeping track of those lately, but it has gone about 50-50 when I did the numbers out on what these series end up being like, whether it's a sweep or a split. This one looks more capable of being a split with the bodies that the Celtics are coming back with, as you mentioned. I don't know, this Celtics team kind of has been a win-loss, win-loss, win-loss kind of team this year, and that's what gets you to 14-14. You mentioned Kemba. That'll probably help them get back in the scoring race that this game ended up becoming on Wednesday. Have more reliable guy that Tatum and Brown can trust to hit some shots, especially off the ball. Tice has been awesome this year, so that one's self-evident that he's going to come in and make some sort of impact here, especially on the defensive side of the floor. But Jeff Teague, when it comes to the ire of Celtics fans this year, it's probably the big three would be Danny Ainge, Brad Stevens, who has gotten a lot of heat from fans this year, and you know, critics and all these different things. But Jeff Teague tops the list. So Jeff Teague, I didn't like letting Brad Wanamaker go. Now, I don't think it's the end of the world to change the needle on this team too much, but you had a guy here who for two seasons developed, got used to the system, played good defense with someone Brad Stevens trusted. And it seemed like, you know, from what I've heard, that he wanted to move on and get a bigger role somewhere else and got a little bit more money in Golden State. So whatever. Kemba's out a month. You need a guy who is a veteran who can score off his own dribble and shot and be able to hold his own at a point guard spot for long minutes there. And so opening night, he comes out, scores 19 points, gets to the free throw line a bunch. They beat the Bucks, and it's like, all right, here's a hit signing. Jeff Teague, like veteran, former All-Star. Maybe he's got a little bit left in the tank to just get us through this month. And I'd say about 90% of the game since, it's just zero. Like defensively, getting torched. Offensively, not able to get into a rhythm. He doesn't have the ball in his hands a lot. And he can hit a couple of threes on kickouts and stuff if he's set up for those. But effectively now that Kemba's back, Payne Pritchard has emerged. He has no real role on this team, which is why I think people were frustrated when he got those key stints in the third and the fourth on Young and on the offensive side, where he was just generally a mess. So I know last year wasn't great for him. He did a little bit better in Atlanta after the trade. But is this just a guy to you who has nothing left? Like, how does this compare what you saw on Wednesday to what you saw from him in Atlanta last year?
Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised that Teague joined a contending team who was going to need his services, like you mentioned, after Wanamaker left for Golden State, just because of the fact that from what I saw last year, and he only played, I think it was 25 games because they traded for him during the year from Minnesota. I think it was 25 games. But in those 25 games, I mean, he was a disaster for the most part because the Hawks needed somebody to really stabilize the second unit whenever Trey sat. And it's been an issue for the team this year. When Trey sits, it's gone terribly wrong because, again, they have Rondo and Brandon Goodwin as the two main backup point guards. They're getting Skylar Mays, their two-way player, some run there. And I think he's looked okay in that role. But for the most part, when Teague ended up being a free agent this year, I would have been shocked if the Hawks brought him back just because of how poor it was last year. It just didn't look like someone who, like you mentioned, had a lot left in the tank. You know, he's not a good shooter. Like, where are the games going? Especially if you're a point guard, you can't shoot. You're not a really good distributor. I don't know what your purpose is anymore if you're a point guard and you can't really do any of those things. So yeah, when I saw that Boston signed him, it definitely caught me by surprise because, again, like coming into the year, Boston's a title contender and they have someone like Teague who's going to have to play a meaningful role most likely. So it's not really a surprise that, you know, Boston fans are frustrated with him.
Yeah, I'm seeing it here in the chat. And some people are saying too, it's not all on him. And I think we do just end up jumping on one of the weaker players on the roster for their struggles and ignore some of the other struggles of other guys. Like Jason Tatum has slipped defensively this year too, which, you know, he's taken on a monster offensive load. But when it comes to the defense and the issues there, there are bigger problems than Jeff Teague. It's just, I too looked at his minutes and said, what's the purpose here? Could you go to a Carson Edwards or a Tremont Waters and at least work towards something in those spots, even if you're going to lose anyway? Just a small frustration in a long season so far, those Jeff Teague minutes against Atlanta on Wednesday. You mentioned Skylar May, though, and I went on another podcast for Celtics Blog and said, we talked about how Skylar May, a two-way guy, came into this game and made a real impact. So could Tremont Waters, another two-way guy, come in and mimic those minutes and try to get on the ball defensively and get the ball moving on the offensive end. I was surprised they didn't do that there. So again, I'm not one of these guys who is hammering up the heat on Brad Stevens, but there have been a few moments this year where you look at him and his rotations, which have gone all over the place, and say, this is probably adding to the inconsistency here. I do want to hit on All-Star. I don't care who makes it. I don't care about the votes and all that stuff. Tatum and Brown should make it, and Trae Young will obviously certainly be there. But I do want to talk about this game. So if you're living in Atlanta, Atlanta's kind of been cast as this center of COVID, fair or not. I guess Florida would be the, COVID mainstay land down there. But, Atlanta's open. Clubs, bars, all that stuff, strip clubs. Like, there's just a lot of places where the COVID could fester down there. And fair or not, the NBA has been wildly criticized for having an All-Star game there. And their take on it is that you can go in one night, go out like it's a road game, like the Celtics are down in Atlanta and about to play a game, and head out the next night. And that's how the All-Star game is going to be set up. All the events are in one night. They'll probably be the same protocols that you can't leave your room. Everybody's stuck in their hotel, and then it's just out of there the next day. They'll probably have a hard time on when all the teams need to be out of there. So this could go perfectly fine. The money was certainly needed by the league there, but I do side with people who say these are the most important players in the NBA. And if anything goes wrong here and there's any spread whatsoever, if someone comes in with an inconclusive test or a test that isn't caught, and this is spread among the players on the court there, I mean, we're talking about a disaster that could feasibly threaten the season here, worst case scenario. Now, I think it could end up being fine with what they have in place here. But, I mean, what's the feeling around Atlanta? I mean, you live there. What's the level of threat that you think this is going to present to the league? And, how is it just being in a city like that where everything's open amid the COVID pandemic here?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is for Atlanta residents like myself is that when you have a massive event like the All-Star game, granted, it's much smaller this year. Like you said, the guys are coming in the day before and, leaving either right after the game or the next morning. So that part is fine because, usually for All-Star week, there's a lot of parties and stuff. But that's the problem, is that when you're living in Atlanta where there's many entertainment options, I'm sure there are going to be other, All-Star events going on. Whether it's sanctioned or not by the NBA, I know Adam Silver was talking about how, there's going to be no NBA-sanctioned events going on in Atlanta. But, I mean, come on, let's be real here. They're going to be events like you see right here that you're showing on the screen. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me that, Silver is talking about there will be no events and whatnot. They're going to be events. It's Atlanta. The clubs are going to be popping on Friday and Saturday nights. The bars are going to be crowded. And, it's kind of, ridiculous in a way because, going into the season, they were talking about how that, safety was going to be important, and yet you have players from all different teams interacting with each other. And like you said, the possibility of there being a positive test or an inconclusive test or whatever it might be could jeopardize the season or at least pause it for a few weeks. So it doesn't make any sense to me, but at the end of the day, it's all about money, and money is always going to win.
Yeah, I saw these posters for these events and just went, uh-oh, here we go. we're asking for one player to end up at one of these events, just step out of line there. And we're just looking at a disaster, not only for this event in particular, but for the weeks to come out of that All-Star break. We just had the Spurs and Hornets get shut down again after the league had reached zero. So now the NBA numbers are ticking up just a little bit again. And could you have them tick up more into the second half? My biggest thing was the league doesn't seem to know right now how it's going to make up these games that have been missed already. I think there's upwards of 30 games that have been postponed. And the All-Star break would seemingly be a time where some of those could be made up, or you're going to look at the second half schedule being even more packed or stretched out if the Olympics get cut off or whatever, which seems like a possibility at this point. The season could be extended. But overall, it just doesn't seem like the All-Star game is going to help that goal in any way. So you're going to have an all-star game and then possibly be just getting rid of some games and going by win percentage and giving up on those as money. Like, this, it's creating a different problem where there doesn't need to be one to me. And I'll say this, like, I'm up on music. I'm 23, but it troubled me that I don't know who Pooh Shiesty is.
I haven't heard who Shiesty. I know who Lil Durk is, but I do not know who Shiesty is.
I don't like being 23 and not knowing who. Apparently, I mean, he's above Lil Durk here on the poster, so I should probably know who he is too if I know who Lil Durk is. But I can't say I do. So yeah, there's our all star. All right. So last thing here, I do want to throw this at you. John Collins' name has been thrown around a ton in trade talks this year. There's been a report that Atlanta is going to listen to offers on him. I guess the thinking is that he's not going to fit into the future plans of Atlanta, or he's going to be too expensive to retain or anything like that. I don't know what the sentiment is on the Atlanta side or how much truth you think there is to the prospect that he could get moved this year. But for a Celtics team that definitely needs a move, some help here, he would probably fit into those plans. There'd be a ton of competition. There would obviously be a big asking price from the Atlanta side. But where do you think John Collins is in the short and long-term plans for this team?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the Hawks are listening to offers on John isn't necessarily new, because they were listening to offers last year at the trade deadline. There were a couple teams who inquired about him. So the fact that it kind of got blown out of proportion in the past few days, just because a couple of national writers tweeted about it. I mean, this has been going on for over a year now that they've been listening to offers. So there's nothing new there. You know, they think John is talented. There's no denying that. I mean, last year he's 20 and 10 and shooting 40% from three. This year he's, I think he was like 18 and 8. His numbers have gone down a little bit just because of the fact that there's more talent on the roster now and more people are getting looks at the rim, Capella specifically. But his efficiency numbers are through the roof. He's been, I haven't looked in the past couple of days after the Boston game, but for most of the season, he's been the guy who's led the team in on-off numbers this season, even with him being 18 and 8. So for the Hawks, they're not just going to trade him for, you know, a bag of chips. They're going to want something, you know, meaningful and impactful if they were to deal him before the trade deadline. So Shams Charania with The Athletic reported that the Hawks were looking for a high first round pick, lottery level talent at least. The problem with, you know, trying to trade John is he only makes $4 million. And when he's obviously worth more than $4 million, it's hard to get something in return that is meaningful for the Hawks side of things. So what I think is going to happen is that the Hawks are certainly going to continue listening to offers. If they do get blown away by an offer before the trade deadline, then Collins is going to be moved. That's just the nature of the business, just because of the fact that when you look at other important decisions that the Hawks are going to have to make, Young is eligible for a max extension starting this summer. Then the following year, you have DeAndre Hunter and Cam Reddish. Kevin Herter is also eligible for an extension this summer. So you have guys on your team that you have to figure out who's a part of this future. If they are not comfortable paying two guys a max deal, I assume that Trey is going to get the max. I mean, it just makes sense that he's going to get the max. They've been building around this guy for 3 years now. So do you want two max contracts, which is what John is looking for in free agency? And he's probably going to get somewhere close to the max, just because of the fact that when you look at the 2021 free agents, he's top three probably. He's 23 years old. He's, again, he has potential to get 20 and 10 every night, shoots 40% from three. He's gotten better defensively. Some team is going to give him money. I look at Dallas as a perfect example of a team that cleared out cap space with the hopes that Giannis was going to become available. Miami has a lot of money. They were trying to get Giannis. Who else? The Spurs. I think he would fit in nicely with San Antonio. So there are teams mm-hmm. that, you know, have money who could potentially offer him, you know, $110, $120 million this year. I mean, in the offseason. So I'm interested to see what's going to happen. You know, the Hawks could decide to play it out, go into free agency, see what that offer is, see what the offer sheet that he signs is, and decide if they want to match or not. If they don't, then, you know, they could obviously work out a sign and trade, which is what Boston did this past offseason with Gordon Hayward.
So this is my idea here. I think I'm going to try to appease both sides in a deal like this, because there's not a lot of stomach for trading Marcus Smart among the Celtics fans, reasonably so. Like, I would hate to see Marcus Smart go. This is a guy who's been with the team since I started covering them. Is like their first pick under Brad Stevens. They set them up to make the playoffs multiple times, multiple Eastern Conference finals. But like you said, Atlanta's going to have to be moved in a deal like this. And you say lottery pick, you know, not a recent lottery pick, but there's a guy who went number six in the draft, lived up to that, defense, playmaking, shooting, and signed for 2 years. And then you could possibly sign him after that. That's the kind of player I think Atlanta would listen mm-hmm. to. Now, maybe it would take more than this, but you bring in Collins, which is something the Celtics would have to do there. Smart's up after next year. If you're signing Collins, you know, he's around for 4 or 5 years then, compared to Smart, who's probably here for 2 years and then gone realistically, which is something we're going to have to start talking about on the Celtics side. So you could get ahead of that a little bit. Bring in Rondo. I know you said he has nothing left, but maybe just as a voice in the room. Better than Jeff Teague, though, I'd say, probably at this point. And this could be the beginning of a deal here. Now, does Atlanta have to get some picks on a deal like this? I just think it makes sense from a team-building standpoint, using the Cantor TP possibly here, or just matching this money to set this up, and then still having the full TP to go from there. Like, this is a deal, to me, that makes so much sense for both sides. Smart can play alongside Young, help him out on the defensive side of the floor, be a defensive piece for that team. To you, who says no to this?
I mean, I think it's a deal that makes a lot of sense for both sides. You know, the Hawks need more defensive talent on the roster, and Marcus is one of the best backcourt defenders in the league. So I think that is a deal that makes a lot of sense. You know, I've seen some people with Boston trades say, like, you know, Collins should be traded for Grant Williams. Who am I missing?
Langford, Aaron Nesmith.
I mean, you're not going to, like, the Hawks aren't going to trade this guy for spare parts. Yeah, I mean, those guys, like, are, you know, could blossom into something down the road. But, you know, you're talking about, again, someone who can get 20 and 10 every night and shoot 40% from three. They're not going to trade him for, again, a bag of chips. They want something. And Marcus Smart is definitely someone who, when I've been looking at like, okay, which teams would make sense for John to go to? Yeah, I think Boston makes a lot of sense. If Boston was able to part ways with Marcus Smart, which I know is tough. He's beloved in Boston. I get that. But when you're talking about adding a talent like John to the roster, it's going to have to cost some sort of price.
So to you, would that be worth it for Boston? I mean, Smart would not be an easy piece to let go. There could be ramifications there defensively, you know, team chemistry-wise, that kind of thing. You lose your heart and soul. That's something you can't measure on the stat sheet and those different kind of things that we talk about there. But Collins, I mean, from what I've seen of him, he looks like he'd be a great fit in this system. You've talked about his defensive improvements, which is the worry with him. Great offensive player, defense the question. But he's 23. He'd be here long term. He's a shooter, slasher, cutter off the ball. And I know people in the comments are saying, oh, they need a big. You know, he's a guy that can play five feasibly in this league a little bit. So there's versatility with him. It's an ability to sign a player you wouldn't be able to sign otherwise, since there's no cap space here. And then keep him long term with the restricted free agency. But on the court specifically, do you think this would be worth it for Boston?
I mean, I do. He's kind of what I think the Celtics need to, you know, be up there with the Brooklyns and Milwaukees and Phillies and all those teams. I think it's a move that could certainly put them over the top and have them in the mix starting this year. I think he's really good. Yeah. I think he's good. I know a lot of people don't watch the Hawks. They're never on national TV. But, you know, from watching John's career in these past 3 years, I mean, he's gotten better every single year. I think there's still room for him to grow. If he can become a little bit better handling the ball and being more of a playmaker, you're talking about one of the better, well-rounded big men in the league. Because, again, he shoots the ball really, really well. So I think it does make sense for, you know, Boston to consider something like this. I think Rajon Rondo would be someone who would be, you know, enthused to join an actual contender. I mean, the Hawks are wanting to get in the playoffs, but like Boston has title aspirations. So perhaps that lights a fire under his belt. Obviously, I mean, he was brilliant with the Celtics and maybe that would spark something inside of him to take it to another gear. He was obviously critical for the Lakers in the playoffs last season. So maybe that side of Rondo's game emerges on an actual contender, who knows. But, you know, I think that if we're talking about realistic trades, I think this is definitely the start of the framework that could get something done for both sides.
Yeah, and it still leaves the Celtics with a ton of ammunition to do other things as well. I mentioned this doesn't even touch the TPE, the $28 million TPE. If there's no picks involved, which maybe there would have to be like one future first protected or something like that going to Atlanta, you know, that leaves you with pick ammunition to make other deals. So people are talking about, oh, Collins wouldn't be the center against Embiid and Giannis and the likes. That's true, but the full front court would still be here. You'd still be able to mix that up somehow, maybe add another wing. Because this Celtics team is multiple moves away with how they look right now. They need more veterans, less young players. And so this double dip idea that I've been coming up with the last few days, where you get Collins and then you still have $28 million to use now or later during the offseason, to me is a no-brainer. Makes the team a lot more expensive, but if you're going for it, if you're the Celtics, you got to, you know, ramp up the payroll, add veterans, guys who can contribute right now. Because as you mentioned, Aaron Nesmith and Romeo Langford and Grant Williams, and that being the rotation, just is a two-sided approach to this team that isn't working right now. Like Brown and Tatum are ready to go. The rest of the roster is not. But he is Kirshner. I just completely botched that. I asked you before the show, too. Sorry, I'm running out of gas 40 minutes in. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Kirshner, K-I-R-C-H-N-E-R. You can read him on theathletic.com, where many of our guests write. So go subscribe over there and check out his coverage, his Magic City piece way back when. We didn't even get to talk about that. It was a fun one in the aftermath of Lou Williams. And he'll probably be all over the All-Star game coming up in a couple of weeks, and the Hawks as well, as the Celtics continue to be connected to them with trade rumors. So, Chris, appreciate you. Nice to meet you. Hopefully we'll talk to you again here in the future.
Yep, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.